so much. I want to start today off with really sharing a story of my time in the military, my time in Afghanistan. I had a little bit different of a job. I was a Force Recon Marine, which is Special Operations in the Marine Corps, and I worked with a Navy SEAL task force called a JSOC task force, a Joint Special Operations Command task force. And so my job really wasn't like you'd imagine, like big military convoys and a lot of buddies to fight alongside. I usually had like one or two partners from my team and a couple of Afghans that we were partnered up with. And we were all thin in civilian clothes, like in this picture here, with big, dirty beards. And we were often in normal vehicles. So this particular day I want to tell you about, I was in a Toyota Prado, which is like a Toyota 4Runner. And we were driving on the eastern side of the city of Kabul, which is the capital of Afghanistan, on a road called Jalalabad Road. And as we were going into the capital city, we noticed a pickup truck behind us. Now, we weren't looking to get any trouble. Again, we were in civilian clothes. We each had a pistol, so we didn't have much weapons to defend ourselves. And so as we looked and seen this truck behind us, it looked like a truck full of Taliban guys. Hilux pickup truck was what they were driving, which is very stereotypical of Taliban fighters. They had big beards. They were dusty, tribal clothing on, AK-47 assault rifles. We even seen an RPG, which is a rocket-propelled grenade launcher. These guys were up to no good. To give you an idea of how many they had in the truck, we always had a joke. How many Taliban can you fit in a Hilux pickup truck? So the answer is one more. Right, they like pile in this truck and they're like hanging out the back and we're like, man, we hope they're not following us. So we did this technique called deviating your route. So I'm on Jalalabad Road and I make a right off of the road. And as I continue to make the block and I come back around, I turn back on my original path, they were following us. And so my technique confirmed to me that they were following us, but it also confirmed to them, now that I knew they were following us, which started a chase. So they start chasing us. And I knew the city of Kabul really well because I lived in a city. I didn't live on a base or anything. So I thought I could lose them in a city. Now, if you ever drive down to Phoenix and you think the traffic's bad down there, well, it has nothing on third world traffic, right? The traffic in Kabul is so bad. There's no traffic lights and the traffic started to get very congested. And I had a very difficult time losing these guys. I was hitting a few cars and I got this major intersection called Masood Circle. And as I got to this intersection, the traffic just began to congest and stop. And all of a sudden, I didn't have anywhere to go. Somehow this truck full of Taliban guys got around us and about 15 yards in front of us, it cut us off. And I remember a few of the guys jumped out the back. I really vividly remember the passenger door open and the guy had an AK-47 rifle. He's looking right at me and he's holding his hand up, motioning for me to stop. Right, we were in a really bad situation. In my experience and in my training, this is called being stuck on the X. Right, the X is it's an ambush site. It's a kill zone. A couple of things you learn in your training about the X is, number one, you have to be able to identify that you're on the X. Right, you got to know you're in a bad situation. And number two, you have to get off the X, right? Simple logic. You stay there, something bad's going to happen. You got to move. And I'm so thankful for all the military training, trained for every scenario possible. And we had trained for this scenario before. It's a roadblock scenario. We execute a ramming technique by pushing the vehicle out of the way. And I did exactly what I was trained to do. I hit the gas and I aim a vehicle towards theirs. And probably one of my favorite memories of Afghanistan is when I smashed into that truck and seen little Taliban guys fly out the back out of the corner of my eye. Right? And knocked that truck out of the way. And then I had a perfect pathway to get off that intersection. But there was like one more obstacle. There was like this 100-year-old policeman. And he had like his nice uniform on and a whistle. And he's blowing his whistle at me to stop. He's like, beep, beep. There's no way I was going to stop. I was going to run this guy over. And what I love about Afghans is they always jump on the winning team. So when he saw I was going to run him over, he was on my team now. He's stopping traffic, blowing his whistle, giving me directions off the intersection. And actually, this guy saved the day that day and got us to safety. You know, I don't know what those guys wanted that day at Masood Circle, but I do know this. If we would have stopped the Masood Circle that day, if we would have stopped on the X, we would have put up a heck of a fight. But the truth is, we probably would have been killed or taken. Now, I'm here to tell you today as a veteran, you don't have to go to Iraq or Afghanistan to find yourself on the X in life, right? I'm sure everybody in this room this morning could think of a time in their life where they were on the X, having to decide whether they're going to stay there or move forward. Now, the question in life isn't if you're going to find yourself on the X. The question is, when you do, what are you going to do? Right? In my own experience from my life and the experience of working at Mighty Oaks Foundation with so many combat veterans who are stuck on the X, essentially, from combat trauma, I learned it really comes down to one thing, and that's a choice. We have the ability to choose whether we want to stay on the X's in our life or we're going to move forward into the lives and purpose that God created us to live. Right? Because if we stay there, either literally or metaphorically, we will die. Now, the Bible has a great illustration for this in the book of Exodus, where God makes a promise to the Israelites to take them from multiple generations of slavery and bondage and lead them into the promised land. A great promise of freedom for these slaves, for the Israelite people. And he communicates this when he talks to Moses in the wilderness, and he tells Moses, I've heard the prayers of my people, and I'm going to set them free. And Moses, I'm going to use you to do it. Now, Moses, I don't think even Moses wanted to do it. He certainly didn't feel qualified, but Moses was obedient, and he chose to do it anyway. Moses goes to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, who's over all these slaves, and you're talking well over a million slaves. Now, when he asked Pharaoh to let his people go, of course, Pharaoh's going to say no. Like, I'm not going to give up my slaves just because you asked me to. So this period of time goes by where this thing happens called the 10 plagues, and this wore Pharaoh down, and eventually Pharaoh decided, okay, I'm going to let these slaves go. Imagine the Israelites. One, they've been slaves for all these multiple generations, all these years, and they're going to be set free by the king of Egypt. And on top of all that, they have a promise from God to be moved into freedom, into the promised land, to have a brand new beginning. They had to leave Israel. They had to leave Egypt so excited. They were probably marching out of there, singing songs, and just so optimistic about the future. But at the first sign of hardship, you see their faith crumble. Right? As they're leaving Egypt, they come down to the banks of the Red Sea. And many of you heard the story about Moses splitting the Red Sea. You just sang about it, right? Before that happened, they actually camped there for the night. And while they were camping there, the Bible says something changed. Something happened. God allowed Pharaoh's heart to be hardened. And Pharaoh changed his mind, and he pursued the Israelites. Not to enslave them again, but to kill them. And he didn't go after them with a truck full of Taliban. The Bible says he went after them with the entire Egyptian army. Every horse, every chariot, Pharaoh himself were going after the Israelites. And they found themselves caught between the Red Sea and this imposing Egyptian army, essentially stuck on the X, and they had to decide what to do. And what did they do? They panicked. Right? They panicked. They did what many of us would do. They forgot that God had given them a promise. They forgot about it, and they started crying out and praying. We go to Exodus 14, verse 9. It says, the Egyptians, all of Pharaoh's horses and chariots, horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them at the Red Sea. In verse 10, as Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified, and they cried out to the Lord. They started praying, right? Maybe sometimes you come on a Sunday morning and get inspired about a promise that God has for you. You pick up from the message, and then a few weeks go by, a crisis hits your life, and you had forgot about God's promise the whole time. When a crisis hits, that's when you start crying out and start praying. That's what happened here. And then the Israelites did what we always do next, look for someone to blame. And they started blaming Moses, right? That's one of hardships, hard parts of leadership. You always get blamed for something. They started blaming Moses. And in verse 11 and 12, they asked Moses, was it because there that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done? What have you done to bring us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians. It would be better for us to serve the Egyptians, better for them to be slaves than to die in the desert. See, these guys forgot the promise that God had for them. What changed? God's promise didn't change. What changed was it got hard, right? Just because God gives you a promise doesn't mean it's not going to get hard. It got hard for them, so they gave up. They forgot. They start crying out. They start praying. But Moses didn't forget God's promise, and he reminds them of it. In verse 13 and 14, Moses tells them, do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance of the Lord will bring today. The Egyptians who you see today, you will never see them again. And the Lord will fight for you. You only need to be still. Now, God speaks here, and I love this. I love what God says. In verse 15, he doesn't say to keep praying. He doesn't say to be still. He says something different. He doesn't say wait for the miracle to happen. No, what he says in verse 15, it says, the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. I love the King James Version where God tells them to go forward, right? To move, to get off the X. Why are you praying right now? If you haven't noticed, the Egyptians are coming and they're going to kill you. It's time to go, like to move forward. You see, the promise was already made, and there's a time to pray. I love praying. I pray a lot. You'll hear why in a little bit, why I pray a lot. So I pray a lot, but there's a time that we pray, the time that we cry out to God, but there's also a time that we have to trust the promises that God has in our life so that we can go forward. You know, pray. In fact, pray daily, cry out to God when you need to, but when you pray knowing God's promise for your life. So when the day comes that you find yourself on the X, you don't have to cry out of fear and out of hopelessness, but you're able to move forward in faith. Now, just like God had a promise for the Israelites, he has a promise for each of us. He has a promise to take us from the bondage and slavery of our lives and lead us to our own promised land, lead us into freedom. Jeremiah 29:11 says, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and a future." That's a promise for you. It's a promise for me. It's a promise for all of us. Now, I wish I could stand up here and say that I always moved forward when I found myself on the X in my life, that I knew or even trusted the promises of God, but that's just not the case. And in 2007, I came home from my 8th deployment from Afghanistan, and I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, something I never saw coming, and I didn't follow those two simple rules. Number one, I didn't identify that I was on the X because of pride or shame. And number two, because of that, I wasn't able to move off of the X. I chose, and I'll emphasize, I chose to stay there for a period of almost 3 years, and it almost cost me everything. My problems in my life, my hardships in my life did not start in Afghanistan. Like I was saying earlier, my family's a three-generation Marine Corps family. It started with my father, who's a Vietnam veteran. He was a 0311 infantry rifleman in Vietnam. And when he came home from Vietnam, I don't know if there was anything available for him to help. I know there wasn't a Mighty Oaks Foundation or anything like that. So he suffered with a lot of the same things that our warriors suffer with today. A lot of things that I suffered with. And there was a lot of alcohol, women, physical abuse in my home. And so if anybody's grown up in a very dysfunctional home like that, you know the siblings get really close. I had a brother who was a year older than me, and we were very close. We went through a lot of physical abuse from my father. And I don't mean belt and spankings. I mean hands, fist-to-face physical abuse in my home. And so we would always talk about joining the military and escaping that life and being in some type of special operations. So when I was 13 and he was 14, we started running and swimming, and that was kind of our escape plan. A year later, when I was 14 and he was 15, he was shot and killed. And he was the closest person to me in my life at that time. So I was devastated. I went into very deep isolation. But as a kid, I just knew to continue pushing forward on that goal. I continued to prepare myself for the military. And when I was 17 years old, I didn't even have a high school diploma. I met a Marine Corps recruiter named Staff Sergeant Brown. And I'll say he rescued me and saved my life by giving me a second chance. I joined the Marine Corps, and it was a brand new chance of life for me. Within the first year, I tried out to be a recon Marine, and I made it. For those that know much about special operations, you spend a lot of years training for that. So a lot of my first years in the military was lots of training. I met Kathy. We got married at 18 and 19 years old. We've been married for 23 years now. Definitely say hi to her out back when you see her. I think she's in childcare right now teaching. Man, it was such an awesome experience to get in that job and work around the most incredible people that you can imagine in the military. But for 10 years, I would train and do this job, and there would be no wars. And for someone, a young guy training for that job, you want to go to war. A lot of ladies sometimes like, why would you want to go to war? Like, you're like some kind of warmonger or something. The best way I know how to describe it to the ladies is like, it's like having a really nice dress and not having any place to go, right? You do all this training, you want to go do what you're trained to do. I wanted to go do this. I remember when those planes flew into the World Trade Center buildings, and I was watching on television with my wife, and I immediately knew like my life was going to be different. It was going to be radically different. And I wanted to go. Like when we went to our unit, no one was at the military units at that time like, oh my gosh, are we going to war? Everyone was like, wait, what's up, sir? Like, when are we going to do this? When are we going to make this right? The military was extremely motivated, and everyone wanted to deploy, and I was one of them. And I got exactly what I asked for. I tried out for this task force. I got on, and I got to do 8 rapid deployments in a 4-year period, and it was everything I had ever wanted to do. I had some bad things happen, but I truly enjoyed my service, and I'm so thankful that I got to serve in that way. I would have thought I was prepared when I went to Afghanistan the first time. We talk about in the military the pillars of resiliency, being mentally tough, being physically tough, being spiritually prepared. I thought I was prepared for all those. I knew how to do my job well. I was in great physical condition. And I would have said I was spiritually prepared because I had to wear Christian stamped on my dog tags. You got to pick something, right? I didn't know what that meant, though. In fact, I was going to church at the time, but I would just come on Sunday and check that box, right? My wife, for me, is like, looking back, it was more of a manipulation, right? If I brought my wife to church, she'd be a faithful and godly woman, a virtuous woman, everything that men want out of their wives, and my kids would go to Sunday school and get character poured into them and discipline poured into them. But like, I looked at other men in the church as weak. I'll just be honest, that's what my viewpoint was. And so I thought there was a disparity between masculinity and Christianity. And so when I got to Afghanistan, I thought I had to make a choice. I had to choose between being a warrior and being a man of faith, and I thought I could put that on a shelf and do it later. Let me tell you, to the men in here, There is no bigger lie of the enemy than that, that somehow we have to choose between masculinity and our faith in Christianity. Because I'll tell you firsthand, there's no one more courageous, bold, and strong on the battlefield of Afghanistan or of life than men of faith. And if not for men of faith, who else will stand up in this world for the things that need to be stood up for? And we need that right now. Amen. And I wish someone would have told me that, because I didn't know that. I chose to put faith on that shelf for later on, and I left a giant hole inside of me that I fill with hate and rage and anger and bitterness. I didn't live on a base. I lived in Afghanistan community with the ate dinner in these people's homes. I played soccer with their kids. I heard stories about what the Taliban had done to them, and then I started to witness what had happened and what was going on to these women and children, and I just began to have this hate inside of me. And I tell you, the command I was at had this Viking mentality and just crushed the enemy. And I bought into it, and it worked really well. My anger and intensity worked really well there. The Afghans I worked with probably had the most hatred towards the Taliban. And it was just this intense environment. And I fed off of it. And we were successful because of it. But I tell you where I wasn't successful is 24 hours later when I get on a plane and be at home. And now I have to go to my house and be a husband and father and Mr. Rogers, like the friendly neighbor. Like, I couldn't do that. Like, I couldn't flip a switch and change. I was still this angry, intense guy. And I'll stand up here, and every time I say this, I have a hard time because I'm ashamed of who I was back then. My children and my wife were scared of me. They were terrified of me. They were like walking on eggshells waiting to say the wrong thing, and I'd flip out. I remember one day, like, my daughter was so excited I was going to be home for her birthday party. And she, you know, she's very opinionated. She still is. She didn't like the icing on her cake. And it was like, just because she didn't like the icing on her cake, I like seen red and flipped out and I grabbed a handful of my little girl's birthday cake in front of everyone. And I threw it against the wall and destroyed my little girl's birthday. I remember even in that moment being like, who does something? What kind of dad does something like that? I did. That's just one example. All the time, I behaved that way. I was like a 15-year-old throwing a temper tantrum when it didn't get my way. And my family had to endure that. Over a period of time, that anger started turning into anxiety. And I started with these physiological symptoms. My arms would go numb. My cheeks would go numb on my face, and I feel like my throat was swelling shut. Sometimes I felt like I couldn't breathe, like I was having a heart attack, like I had like a 1,000-pound weight on my chest. And I knew it was stress. I knew it was anxiety, but I didn't want to say anything to the guys I worked with, because in this little community I was in, I knew the guys would think I was weak, and I wouldn't be able to do my job anymore. So I just pushed it down, kept trying to do my job. And I was able to for a little while, but those symptoms only got worse. It progressed into these moments to where I almost felt like an out-of-body experience, and then to where I started forgetting, having these blackouts in time. My last deployment, I remember leaving, and my son Hunter was, you know, the oldest one that's leaving, left for Afghanistan yesterday. When he was saying goodbye to me for my last time, his little legs were so weak, he couldn't even hold himself up. He was crying. And I remember, even though I didn't have a relationship with God at the time, I was prayed for him that he would have, that God would replace him with another dad when I didn't come home. I had this very imminent sense of doom in my mind. We had some friends that just got killed over there. We were all working together. Some things were happening. And the pressure of all of that, it just overtook me. I was in Afghanistan, and I had this moment of clarity where I almost like woke up from a dream, and I realized I hadn't really been aware for a period of about 2 weeks. And so I raised my hand and said I had a problem going on. And they brought me home, and I sat before a psychologist, and I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, as Pastor Ron said, I hate the word disordered. We wrote a book about it. I do a lot of speaking about it. I don't believe when our body responds normally, the way God created us to respond, it's a disorder at all. We see things and do things in this world that we never were intended to do, and things we weren't intended to see, and our body responds a certain way. Nonetheless, those symptoms that I was facing were very real. I felt like I was going to die at any moment. I felt like my body was just going to stop working. If anybody's had panic attacks, you know what I'm talking about. I just felt very hopeless, and like my next breath was going to be my last one. And on top of all that, I felt so ashamed. It was like if I was in the Super Bowl and worked my whole life to make it as an NFL player, which I would never be because I'm only 5'3", right? But I made it to the Super Bowl, right? And I get to halftime, I get pulled out in the middle of the game. That's what I felt like. I felt like I totally failed my team. And I was ashamed. And I didn't know what else to do. And so my wife and my counselor were talking to me, trying to get me out of this rut. I didn't like the medicine because it made me feel so numb. And so they told me that I should go in the mats and do jiu-jitsu. Now, I'd say I did jiu-jitsu since I was little. But I'm still little, right? But, I did it since I was 5 years old. I did it my whole life, so he thought it'd be good for me. And so I did, and I poured myself into it. I had already been a professional fighter. I was doing it on the side, and I was successful. I was undefeated. And so I just immersed my life into that. Now, jiu-jitsu's a good thing for me. I think doing physical outlets are very good for people that are struggling like that. But you can have a medicine for a cold, and you could abuse that medicine. And that's what I did. I still love jiu-jitsu. I do it every day. I train here in town and Prescott Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I train, and doing ministry is very hard and stressful. Pastor Ron, I'll tell you. So if I have a bad day at the office, I go to the gym, 19-year-old stud, and I choke him out. Right? It makes me feel better, and I get back out to sharing the gospel through our ministry. I mean, jiu-jitsu is good for me, but look, I abused that. I didn't get better. I didn't get well. I chose to hide in that. And anytime you put a lot of time into something, you should be successful, right? You should stop doing it. And I was successful at this. I had like 1,000 students in my school. Some of these pictures, right? I was fighting in the top. I was ranked number one in the U.S., number six in the world as a flyweight. I won a world title belt. I became 18-2. I fought on Showtime, pay-per-view, all these things. And what I was building was this really fake facade of success. In a world where everyone was telling me everything I wanted to hear, and no one was telling me what I needed to hear. And there's no more dangerous place on the planet, not in Afghanistan or Iraq, nowhere more dangerous on this planet to be without accountability in your life, and I had none. Like, I was like a train heading to crash into a wall with no brakes at all. It was a matter of time. Right? And I was still, despite all that success, I was still struggling with panic attacks. My wife and children were still scared of me because of my temper tantrums. Throwing things, breaking things, yelling at people, right? And my marriage was falling apart. Many nights I spent sleeping in that gym. Many nights I would spend at other friends' house or sleeping in one of my kids' bedrooms. Probably the loneliest place I've ever been in my life is not in Afghanistan. It's been in my own bed with my wife's back turned to me in a dead marriage. I thought our marriage was over. She did too. And it didn't take long with the attention you get from a sport like this to walk out of our marriage into relationships with other women, into an affair. Sitting my wife and children down and telling them we were going to get divorced, that it was going to be better. Telling our children it was going to be better. They wouldn't have to hear the fighting anymore. It wasn't going to be better. Our children were devastated. But we decided to anyway. We sold our home. We signed two separate leases on 12-month leases on apartments. My wife filed for the divorce paperwork. And my wife and I had two very different reactions. My wife went into a church. The Heights really reminds me of the church that she went into, the Woods Edge in Texas. She went in this church and she started praying for me. She wouldn't just go on Sundays. People would say that she would go like different days of the week. And every time I stand on a platform in a church, I always think of this left side because people would say she sat against that wall and sometimes she would just collapse. She couldn't even stand up because she'd be crying. And I've asked her and she's answered me, how could you pray for me when I was doing this to you, when I was betraying you in this way? She said she would just pray, God, let me see Chad the way you see Chad. Let me love Chad the way you love Chad. And let me forgive Chad the way you forgave Chad. That's what she would pray for me when I was completely betraying my family. And meanwhile, I'm in this apartment, and I'm like not having to deal with anyone anymore, right? Because everyone's an idiot. That was my mentality, right? My dad, the military, my wife, because she didn't understand, right? Everyone's an idiot. It's true. There's a lot of idiots out there. We all know that. But in this situation, I looked at myself and I'm like, I'm the common denominator, right? It's me. I put this pain on my family, and so I need to fix it. And my problem-solving mind, I thought, if I could remove myself from the situation, they're going to be better off, right? I thought, they'll be sad without me, but they're going to be better off. Unfortunately, that sad, hopeless thought hits the hearts of 20-plus veterans every day in a 20-plus veteran suicide rate. I decided they were going to be better off without me. And I decided I was going to take my life. I would sit in my closet with my family pictures down, and I had a Glock pistol, and I would try to decide how I was going to do it. What kept me from doing it was the thought that my kids would be the one that would find me because my son had the only key to my apartment, and I knew they would be the one that would find me. And so that delayed me. And then Kathy came to my apartment and unwittingly saved my life because I was sitting in that closet and she knocked on the door. I slid the pistol under her blanket and answered the door and we got in a big fight. And she asked me a question that radically changed my life. She asked me how I could do everything I did in the military, right? She saw me become a recon Marine. She saw these pre-deployment trainings. She knew the kind of work we were doing. She saw me train for these fights. Like, I cut like 35 pounds. I'm not a big guy cutting 35 pounds for these fights. The amount of discipline it takes to do that. She's like, how could you do all of that? And when it comes to your family, you'll quit. And for me, like, I don't know about the rest of the men in this room, but there's no more soul-cutting word than to be called a quitter. And she was absolutely right. I quit on the most important things in my life. I quit on being a husband. I quit on being a father. That young 17-year-old kid that raised his hand to serve our country and do something important with his life. I quit on all those things. Not only my own health, but I quit on my own will to live. And I knew I had to make a change. I'm a pretty radical decision maker. So I like, in that moment, I could look back and it was almost like a 180. But I didn't know how to do it. I knew I couldn't do it with the people I had in my life because people were telling me whatever I wanted to hear. But I knew I couldn't do it alone. And so I asked my wife, is there someone at this church you're going to, some man that could help me? And she introduced me to a man named Steve Toth. He just so happened to be on call as an elder at the church. And when I met Steve, I met him at a Starbucks. And he had never served in the military. He wasn't an MMA fighter. He was a small business owner. But he had the perfect gift to help me. He had ADD, like really bad. Like the guy has no patience at all. And why that was a gift, because I was so manipulative. Like I would have said all the right things. Like I was, in the word Smith, I would have said everything he wanted to hear. But he just didn't have the patience for that. And I sat down across from him at Starbucks and I had written for the military guys, I wrote a 5-paragraph order, or operational plan. It was really good, guys. Like how I was going to fix my life. And I slid it over to him, like super proud and smug. And he put his hand on that paper and slid it right back over to me and tapped on him and told me I was going to fail. I remember being like so offended because I put some work into this, like did my homework, and he's telling me I'm going to fail. And as he tapped on it, he said, if this doesn't have anything to do with your relationship with God, I'm not going to waste your time and I'm not going to let you waste mine. I remember really processing that moment. And we have a saying at our foundation at Mighty Oaks, if what you're doing isn't working, then why not try something different? Right? If what you're doing in your life isn't working, then why not try something different? I had tried everything. I tried the pills. I tried the counseling, I tried the sports, the MMA and jiu-jitsu. Some of those things were good, some of those things were bad, right? But nothing had worked. It was time for me to try something different. And so I trusted this man, Steve, and I submitted my life to Christ. I didn't know what was next from that, but what I do know is this. When nothing else had worked in my life, when I simply made a decision to align my life with the life that I was created to live, everything changed for me. Everything radically changed for me. Beyond that decision, Steve mentored me and invested in me and discipled me for a period of 1 year in biblical manhood. And through that process, what I discovered was so profound to me. I discovered that the incidents of my past, as bad as some of those things may have been in my childhood in Afghanistan, those things didn't lead me to be in that closet with my pistol in my hand. What led me there were the choices I had made in response to those things. And no one could ever take away my ability to choose differently moving forward. And as cliche as it may sound, right, I realized that I didn't have to let my past define my future. One of my favorite verses is in the book of Philippians when Paul says to the church of Philippi, he says, I don't have it all figured out, right? Kind of same message I'm telling you today. I don't have it all figured out. But what Paul says, but what I do know is this: I need to forget the past and strain forward to the things that are ahead. See, God doesn't save us from something. He saves us for something. He saves us for a purpose. He has a reason for us to be here. We have a reason for our life. He doesn't give us a hope and a future for us to just be happy and enjoy it, right? He has a purpose for us. There's a mission in this world for each of us. Through that revelation, I didn't only find restoration in my marriage and my family, but I found hope for the first time in a long time. And I found what Paul was talking about, and it's, I think what's all of us search our whole life for, and that's purpose. We were created to have purpose. We need to wake up in the morning and know what's ahead of us. And fortunately, God has a purpose for us. We just have to tap into it. Mark Twain says it like this: the two most important days in a person's life are the day that they're born and the day that they find out why. I felt when Steve introduced me to the life that God created me to live, I found out why. And it's honestly, it's to be here today. It's to share the story of Christ in my life, to share the truth that I found and discovered with others. When I was going through this, I thought I was the only one that could possibly be hurting the way I was hurting. The only one's marriage could be as bad as mine. The only one that felt so hopeless that they didn't want to live anymore. But the truth is, I wasn't the only one. There were many other people struggling, but I had found the cure. It was like I was dying of stage 4 cancer and somebody gave me the cure. Like, I couldn't keep that to myself. I have to tell everyone I can. So I felt not only a desire, but an obligation to share that. And so Kathy and I decided, and we felt called, to start Mighty Oaks Foundation. We were in no place or had no business starting a foundation. We were still bleeding. We didn't have any idea what we were doing. We just felt so compelled we had to. And I'm so thankful to God that he gave us the courage to be obedient to do that, because today we've been able to share that message with so many people outside of churches and places that we get to go around and share God's story with. We've spoken just in the last 2 years to over 100,000 active duty troops, where bases invite us to speak to troops and understand that they need to not just be mentally and physically strong, but they need to be spiritually strong. Next weekend, I'm going to Marine Corps boot camp. I do it every quarter for 3 years now, and get to talk to these kids, these brand new kids in the Marine Corps, about spiritual strength and how they don't have to decide whether they want to be a person of faith or be a warrior. They can know that they can be a person of faith and have a relationship with Christ and still be a warrior and be not only combat effective, but resilient and be able to bounce back. I'm so thankful that we get to go out and share that message. And then we have this program that you see this picture here. We run 31-week camps. 30 of them a year, 1 week long, they're intensives. Steve worked with me for a whole year when he discipled me. I'm kind of in the worst case scenario, right? These guys take a week. No, we work with them longer than a week, but a week at a time, right? And when they come to the program, the foundation, we're so blessed that we've done all this for free. We don't charge the guys anything, including travel. We take care of getting the guys there. We have 4 ranches around the country these guys get to go to. And it's just been an incredible success, and to be a part of it has been a blessing to me. Pastor Ron, I'll make sure you guys know as well, but guys, we have flyers at the back table. Again, these programs are totally free. If you're a veteran or know a veteran struggling, I say this every time I speak, please reach out to us for the cure, that solution. We also take care of spouses as well, and run marriage programs as well. So please reach out. First responders too. At the table in the back is information on that. Okay. Back to you guys. God's promise of hope and restoration, it's not reserved for these guys. It's not reserved for combat veterans. It's not reserved for the Israelites. It's for all of us. It's for you. There's a million ways in this world that we can be hurt, that we can get off track, but I'm pretty convinced that there's only one way to get well. There's only one way to get back on track. There's only one way to tap into our purpose, and that's through a relationship with Jesus Christ. Amen. And I don't think there's any workarounds for that. I've seen plenty of people try and fall short. Life is hard. And we're all going to find ourselves on the X in our life. But whenever you do, you have to know God's promise for you. You have to know God has a purpose for you. I mean, whatever you're struggling with, the list is long, right? It could be anger, depression, fear, selfishness, laziness, addictions, lack of purpose. Whatever it is, know God's promise for you. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. Sometimes I pray that verse will lead you to your knees in prayer and you can cry out to God. But other times I pray that knowledge will give you the very strength you need to move forward off the X into the lives that you're created to live. Can I pray for you? Lord, it's New Year's week, a week many of us will make resolutions and look for new beginnings. There comes a time in life where we have to let go of our past, Lord, and we have to step off that X and move forward and grab a hold of the future that you have in store for us. I thank you, Lord, that you laid out a plan for us to do that through a relationship with you, through a relationship with Christ. Lord, that you would not just save us from something in life, but you'd save us for something, and you have a purpose for us. Thank you for not just creating us, Lord, but thank you for creating us for that purpose, to be world changers and to be kingdom builders. Lord, in this new year, I pray you to give us, each of us, the strength, Lord, to step out from our past and into the future and purpose that you've created each of us for. In Jesus' name.